Okay, good evening, everybody, and thanks for coming. My name is Francisco Panizza, and I am professor of Latin American and Comparative Politics at the government department who is hosting this event. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce our speaker today, who is Ed Williams, Chief Executive Officer and Vice Chairman Europe of Edelman. Ed leads Edelman UK and Ireland business and is also Vice Chairman Europe. Before joining the firm in 2011, he oversaw communications for two global media companies, the BBC and Reuters. He advises senior executives on corporate communications and strategy, as well as issues and crisis management. As a former TV and print journalist, he still likes to turn his hand to speech and op-ed writing. Ed serves on a number of boards, including the Royal College of Art, the Wolf Institute, and the Crisis Group International Advisory Council. A graduate of Harvard Business School, he's one of the Evening Standard's 1,000 most influential Londoners. So Ed will speak for about 35, 40 minutes, and then we open the floor to your questions. This event is being recorded, and hopefully, if the technology goes all right, it will be published as a podcast. And in terms of the Twitter hashtag is hashtag fake news. Ed.
Very good. Thanks very much, and thank you, Dr. Panizza, for inviting me here to speak tonight, and thanks to all at the LSE. So look, I'm going to talk to you tonight really through five numbers. Numbers are 60, 29, 61, 19, and 34. Now, these abstract numbers go quite a long way to explaining what I believe is happening in terms of the relationship between the media and the public in many countries around the world. Now, I should start by saying these are proprietary numbers. They're taken from the 2018 Edelman Trust Barometer, which we launched just last month ahead of the World Economic Forum in Davos. Now, some of you will be familiar with this global survey. It's been running for the past 18 years. And we speak to over 33,000 people in 28 countries in what is the world's largest tracking study of trust. Now, we look at trust across a variety of institutions, government, business, NGOs, and the media. But this year in particular, we decided to concentrate on the media. And the reason was, actually, when you think about it, 2017 was a hell of a year to be in journalism for a whole host of reasons, many of them to do with a certain gentleman in the White House. It was the year in which the media became the story. It's also a year when the media was bad-mouthed more so than at any other time, certainly in my career or my memory. The media was described as crooked, as biased, as fake, as dead. And another precedent was set when President Trump became the first man in the Oval Office to announce his own fake news awards, which predictably were won by the usual suspects, CNN, the New York Times, ABC, the Washington Post, Time, Newsweek. The paid subscriptions of these outlets, you can imagine clicking up actually as Trump tweeted out the results. 2017 was also the year that the regulatory crosshairs started to train themselves on big tech, and more specifically, social media platforms, which are both, as you will know, a blessing and a curse for traditional news media and professional journalism. Now, when we started to think about this year's trust barometer, we noted that up to now we'd been watching a six-year decline in trust in traditional media. The trend had been going in a negative direction over the last 6 years. So our starting point was to try and figure out what the hell is going wrong. Why are we seeing this decline over this period of time? Now, first, a caveat on the numbers before we get into them. I said there are 28 countries in the research, and it's easy to look at kind of macro trends in aggregate and therefore miss a lot of the really interesting detail. So what I've decided to do for tonight's discussion is actually to group findings together where it makes sense to do so. So we've got the G8 as a proxy, ignoring Russia's suspension, of course, because they're quite, it's quite an important benchmark, the G8, I would say, to give you a kind of meaningful picture. We've also got data here from Britain. And the reason I've used UK data where I have used it is to illustrate one or two important points. And it's also worth saying in the UK, we do a very big piece of supplementary research. It's about a 3,500-person study that supports the core trust study each year. But what I think we're seeing in the UK, and you'll see later in this talk, is I think some factors and some phenomenon that we're going to see elsewhere in the world over time. So let's get ahead to the numbers. The first number I promised you was 60. Now, this is the percentage of people this year across the G8 who say they trust what we call the traditional media as a source of news. That is to say, newspapers, television, and radio. Now, I mentioned that we've been watching a steady decline in this number over the past 6 years, and here's the first surprise from this year's data. It's up, and it's up significantly. In the UK, it's up 13 points from 48 to 61. And it's not just in this country. Across the G8, the year-on-year rise from last year is 8 points. Now, bearing in mind the other numbers that I'll come to in a minute, we're pretty certain this increase in trust is a mark of people's desire to find authoritative sources in a sea of disinformation and misinformation. It is, you could argue, the definition of a flight to quality. Now, we began to see this flight in the immediate aftermath of the US election. The New York Times reported that in the 7-day period after Trump's victory, it had a net increase of 41,000 new paid subscribers to its news products. That was just 1 week after the victory. It was the largest 1-week subscription increase since 2011. Slate, another US media business, saw a 65% increase in its premium membership, up 30,000 within 3 months of the election. Vanity Fair sold a further 107,000 subscriptions in a flash sale within a month after Donald Trump's win and after he specifically insulted Graydon Carter, the former editor. The New Yorker had its biggest subscription month on record, selling 100,000 copies around Trump's inauguration. And ProPublica, the non-profit investigative outfit, saw donations soar 10 times the usual rate in the days after the election. The Washington Post has now celebrated its second year of profitability. Digital subscriptions have tripled in the last year. So this man on the slides has done more for paid media subscriptions than any other whiz-bang business strategy, and who would have thought? And as I was saying to the doctor before I came on, I remember last year talking around the Trump victory to the chief executive of the New York Times about what would the impact of Trump's victory mean for the paper in respect to the president attaching the word failing to the NYT hashtag in all of his commentary. And we can see from the results, it's actually been commercially a rather good thing. And around the world, we've seen other increases in global brands. Economist, FT, and others are seeing similar paid subscriptions going up. It's also worth saying, amid the kind of the common, you know, conventional wisdom is that traditional media doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't pack the punch that it used to have. Well, let's look at last week's, or actually, sorry, it's a fortnight ago now, the Financial Times coverage of the President's Club. I just wonder if that was a story covered by Vice, whether we would have seen the same political and business reaction that we saw. And similarly, if you stick on the FT as a title, you'll all be aware of the catastrophic events of last year for Bell Pottinger, the PR company, yet again proving the rule that you cannot survive 4 days on the front of the FT without it reverberating far and wide, and in their case, insolvency. So trust in legacy media is increasing, and this is, of course, brilliant news for news brands, as a window of opportunity is there to reboot relations with consumers and ad markets. The truth is, the picture is a lot more complicated than that. So this leads me to the second number, 29. This is the percentage of people on average in G8 countries who say they trust social media as a source for news and information. This is the very platform that many people use to encounter traditional media news content. That number is down 4 points. In the US, it's down 9 points. Of course, there are outliers. Trust in social media in companies like, in countries like India, China, and Mexico, kind of double this level. But in the UK, the number is now 24%. Less than a quarter in this country trust social media for news and information. And the reason that is the case, I would argue, boils down to two things. First, social media is increasingly seen as a kind of dubious information stew, with things like fake news swimming around with clickbait alongside high-quality, professionally produced journalism. Second, there's a sense that social media companies aren't doing anywhere near enough to ensure that their environments are safe or that the information that they're spreading amongst their users is trustworthy. So look, here's a fun exercise. Try putting social media is ... into your Google search bar. Here's what you'll find. So social media is fake, destroying society, dangerous, toxic, ruining our lives. You get the point. And that's Google. One way to look at this is that that number, 29, has the potential to be good news for traditional media. One's descent, if you like, has led to the other's rise. Or taken together, you might think the gap between the two is the kind of credibility gap. But again, it's not quite the full picture. So the third number I want to highlight is 61. And this is when the news becomes less good for traditional media, because this is the number of people globally who cannot tell the difference between professionally produced news and fakery. It's the highest in the US, where it tops out at 70. So that is to say, 70% of Americans can't tell the difference between professional content and fake content. These are the precise flames that the president is fanning. So if I go back to my kind of metaphor of the information stew, people say it's really difficult to tell when you plunge your spoon in whether you're going to find something nutritious, whether it's the equivalent of junk food, or whether you're going to be poisoned. And look at it a slightly different way. We also know that less than a quarter, 24% of people, think social media does a good job of separating fact from fiction. Put it another way, 76% disagree with that statement. There's a sense that trusted sources look indistinguishable from the bad stuff. And you can understand why. I mean, take a look at this. Some of you will have seen this, perhaps, on your feeds. It's a story that cropped up last year. And hopefully, there it is. It's a pretty convincing copy of The Guardian. Actually, it looks like The Guardian. And the story asserts that the Georgian and Crimean wars were cooked up by Britain and America to try to topple Putin. It contains a very lengthy quote attributed to the former head of MI6, John Scala. Now, The Guardian is not famous for its snappy headlines, but even you would think a headline like this might have been stopped by some of the subs. Former MI6 chief admits defeat to Putin on the Russia fragmentation strategic plan. I mean, it's not a great headline, and it does suggest perhaps that this might not be original Guardian content. Despite the timestamp and the country stamp. But on closer reading, you will see that this is absolutely riddled with grammatical errors, which is easily spotted by anyone in this room. But the fraudsters went to extraordinary lengths to make this look like Guardian content. They even used a Turkish language character in the URL to appear like the I in Guardian.com.
So at first glance, this is, you can see really, can't you, why, you know, it's 61% of people feel that they can't, you know, they really struggle to differentiate between professional content, certainly at quick glance, cursory glance, and fake. And I'm using this point really just to make that point that if this stuff shows up in our news feeds, or has been validated by friends through likes and shares, you can see how it starts to just build a momentum and just and is disseminated around the world. Now, look, it's tempting to isolate the two numbers that I've talked about. 61, those who can't tell the difference between real and fake, and 29, those who trust social media as a source of news and conclude that one is a symptom of the other. But you'd only be partially right. In my mind, it is a little bit more complicated. Yes, the two are connected, but these figures also speak to a lack of communication by professional publishers and broadcasters, and I'm going to come to that a little bit later. Now, my fourth and least favourite number is 19. This is a British number. It's from the UK data set. And what it says is that one-fifth of the population told us that they now deliberately avoid the news media. Now, this number is from a single country, but I would hazard a guess that it's not atypical. Similar studies done by the Reuters Institute for Journalism in Oxford have found these kind of numbers elsewhere in the world. And whilst it's true that Britons have a lot of reason to avoid the news, it's kind of a raucous and occasionally libelous tabloid press, incredibly bad-tempered Brexit campaign, and so on and so forth, we do have the broadest and most balanced and most pluralistic media environment in the world. And while Brexit and the rise of Jeremy Corbyn are signs that Britain has shifted to a more populist taste in politics, in general, the plurality and freedom of the press is one of the reasons this country has been resilient in the face of some of the more hardcore populist movements. Britons are not extremists. Look at what's happening to the slow and slightly embarrassing, dare I say it, demise of UKIP. As soon as its function was complete, it's just faded away. Compare that to the rise of AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, or the Five Star movement in Italy. And then look further afield to countries where freedom of the press is in genuine peril. Take the Philippines, where a weak press, more smartphones than people, and exceedingly high Facebook penetration has met the blunt force of a repressive political regime. President Duterte, I think, delivered a world first by banning the press from his inauguration and live-streaming it on, you guessed it, Facebook. He then co-opted social media to wage war against his opponents, and we're talking about opposition parties, human rights activists, minority populations, and journalists as well. This is playing out in a number of other countries as well around the world, like Cambodia and South Africa. And for those of you who want to read a little bit more about this, I would recommend two excellent pieces of reporting, one by Business Week and the other by BuzzFeed, that are looking at looking at how countries are using social media to advance kind of repressive and populist agendas. Elsewhere, and even closer to home, in places like Poland and Hungary, we're seeing populist parties corrode the free press. You'll be aware, I'm sure, of Poland's Law and Justice Party, which has tightened its grip on the media. In a law passed last year, the government now has direct control of state-run TV and radio. Its management board and editorial team are now staffed with party apparatchiks. According to a report by Freedom House, the clampdown on media is part of a broader push to silence independent voices. Meanwhile, the government continues to threaten repolonization of private media through restrictions on foreign ownership and a broader push to marginalise supposedly unpatriotic views. Those critical of the current government have reported losing lucrative advertising contracts. The tone towards journalism there echoes what's also happening in Viktor Orban's Hungary, where a law was passed that allows government to punish media for, quote, unbalanced or insulting coverage. In 2016, the country's most influential daily paper was bought by an ally of Orbán, and it was promptly shut down in a move to silence vocal critics like Poland. The government also seeks to control the media through the selective awarding of advertising contracts and radio broadcasting frequencies. And separately, the government has taken steps to limit the scope of the country's freedom of information law. Now, there are, of course, you would say to me, examples of populist campaigns creeping into the national press in this country. For example, when the Daily Mail referred to the three High Court judges as, quote, enemies of the people. The point is, we still do have a free press, a vibrant press, and a pluralistic press in this country. But back to this point about news avoidance and that number on the screen, 19. Three explanations come out on top when you ask the question, what the hell is happening? Why are people actively avoiding the news? The first is because it is depressing, people say. They find the news just too negative and they don't want to watch it or consume it. The second is a belief that the news and news reporting is biased, that there are biases either on the right or on the left that are creeping into coverage. And I mean, anecdotally, I must tell you, having sat at the top of the BBC and worked with the previous Director General for many years, I mean, that is something that the BBC has always been accused of. Hilariously, though, from both the left and the right. The third reason that people say they're actively avoiding the news is this sense that there are hidden agendas at play, that there are kind of conspiracies, that news is kept away from the public. People also say there's too much analysis, they say there's too much commentary, forced on them by what they believe is this kind of unrelenting 24-hour news cycle. Now, I'd argue that it's actually the poisonous thread of fake news that explains this strongly held view about conspiracies, and this is the belief that the kind of deep political and media state suppresses news stories and chooses the news diet the public should be fed. And, you know, what's most surprising about this is the more educated and the higher income you are, the more likely you are to avoid the news. The problem of news avoidance is not a low income problem, it's a top quartile income problem. And the same goes for the problem of conspiracy theories. You know, you all will have seen the conspiracy theories around Grenfell. Many of those were held by people with good educations in well-paid jobs. Now, in my view, given the issues we face, it should be extremely concerning that we, at least in this country, are becoming a nation of news skimmers, another new phenomenon we should worry about, and also news avoiders. I mean, one observation is perhaps the media has got ahead of the public in some way. Economic liberalism, the change in social and sexual mores, multiculturalism have created too large a gap between the metropolitan media and the masses. Perhaps this is why in focus groups that I participated in out of London, I've heard people say that the media doesn't reflect their lives and is distant and is uncomprehending. The question is how you listen and reflect these perspectives rather than creating cultural divisions. But however you look at it, any sector where one in five people are now actively avoiding your product and a further one in three are consuming less of it than a year ago, you ought to be asking serious questions about how you address this problem, how you rebuild trust in professional journalism, how you engage with the public. So, the next number, 34. Now, I'm often accused of being kind of Dr. Doom, of belabouring doomsday scenarios. So, I thought I would end up in this talk leaving you with a positive number, if you like. And I know it's a low number, but it does offer potentially some hope. 34 is the number in percentage points of people who say that they now trust journalists to be credible sources of information across the G8. Now look, at first glance this number looks small, and it is, but it year on year the uptick is quite significant. Across the G8, trust in journalists has gone up 13 points in a year. It follows a trend that we are seeing right around the world of a turnaround of the fortune of experts. CEOs, boards, government officials, industry analysts, all are up, in some cases by double digits. I don't know if Michael Gove is in the audience tonight, I suspect he isn't, but it turns out we quite like experts now. So why are we returning to them? So here's my take. What Brexit and Trump, and much of what unfolded in the latter half of 2016 and 2017, showed writ large an effect similar to the Dunning-Kruger effect. Now, some of you will be familiar with these, but for those who aren't, let me explain. It's the cognitive bias whereby the least proficient people are the ones most likely to overestimate their own abilities. The theory goes that the less qualified and experienced you are, the more likely you are to overstate your own competency and judgment. Those who are the least qualified have higher levels of competence than those who are the most qualified. We think, for example, that we have sound political or policy judgment. We think we know better than the governor of the Bank of England, the head of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, or the Office for Budget Responsibility on the impact of Brexit on the economy. Take on the one hand a typical Trump supporter, and on the other hand someone who says Brexit is an impossibility and Trump a joke. Both are guilty in some respects. The Trump supporter might like what they hear from the president, but not know anything or hold him to account for the more serious faults, and in some cases might not even recognise them in the first place. The Brexit refusenik, oblivious to the world outside their metropolitan bubble, similarly finds themselves increasingly confident of their own judgments, absorbent of facts that support only their point of view. Neither are necessarily uninformed so much as partially informed. Their heads and their news feeds are filled with false data, alternative facts, the like, and inevitably this breeds overconfidence about certainty of facts. And the important thing to state with this slide, by the way, you can be on the far right an expert and also reside on Mount Stupid. So you can, in this model, be, for example, a world expert on brain science, yet have extraordinary confidence about politics. The difference with the brain science expert, he knows or she knows what they don't know. That's the gap between the summit of Mount Stupidity and the top of the expert. You know, when all of this happens, people experience this surge of partial information or indeed misinformation on such a vast scale as it has recently, and then they live with the consequences of overconfidence. We would see, I'd argue, a clamour back to credible expertise, listening to people on the right, academics, established media, traditional journalism, business. It manifests itself as a desire for reliable information, professional rigour and respect for accuracy and accountability. We are, I think, rejecting crowdthink and instead seeking information from those who have a degree of expertise or knowledge. So 34, a small number, but one that we should be concentrating on and one that I think is a good number. If there's one thing that's going to push the world back towards what it was when it was possible to make money out of telling the truth, it's the realisation that there is such a thing as the truth. Not truthiness, not my truth, or your truth, or half-truths. The objective truth, which we should continue to all remind people, actually is a thing. And that truth is the basis of trust between individuals as much as between the media and the public. So finally, as we look at what's ahead for 2018, what do I see for traditional media and professional journalism? I think we could be on the brink of a pendulum swinging back towards sustained trust in journalism and traditional media, a world where expertise counts and is listened to. I say I think because this is 1 year's data. Okay, so we can talk about next year, but I think there is enough here to suggest that perhaps the pendulum is swinging back. Yet at the same time, the objective truth that high-quality journalism is striving for is continuing to be eroded by the wild west of social media platforms, which create credibility doubts and which are being exploited by populist leaders who, as we've heard, are menacing the free press in many countries. Policing these spaces, either through better self-regulation or blunt state intervention, will inevitably be to the benefit of traditional media over time. This should be designed to provide confidence in the information sources that people encounter. But the media itself also needs to do a far better job of labelling and demonstrating its objectivity, its value, its contribution to the public good, and fulfilling its role of holding those in power to account. The question is, as disruption continues with the dual threat of declining consumption and news avoidance, whether traditional media has the time on its side to wait for this inevitable regulatory change, and therefore what in the short term it can do to turn the rise in trust we saw this year into something far more sustainable. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed. We can now open the floor. Who wants to shoot first?
Yep.
My name is Artyom. I'm a postgrad student of LSE. And my question concerns the fake news problem that you've mentioned. Do you believe in any kind of successful counter-regulation to fake news? Can a state intervene in a human rights consistent and effective manner?
It's a brilliant question, and it's a sort of, you start, my friend, with the million-dollar question, if you like, which is, what is the kind of regulatory response? And when you look around the world, countries are looking at different answers to that question. So you'll be aware of the NETS, the D, legislation in Germany, which is a pretty blunt piece of legislation, which is essentially fining tech businesses, media, social media companies, if they publish and broadcast content that is deemed irresponsible against a variety of tests. In France, Macron has asked for a judicial answer to the problem of how you regulate social media companies and big tech. In this country, there is a inquiry at the moment that the Media Select Committee is in the middle of. In fact, they were in Washington and New York last week asking some pretty difficult questions about this. Now, of course, you look at Germany, and that there are many attractive reasons for thinking that's quite a good regulatory solution, particularly on the issue of broadcasting extremist content, right? I'll come to fake news in a second. But go to America, that's not going to work. So in a country where freedom of speech is incredibly important, and a country where individuals like Alex Jones can broadcast what I personally think is really grotesque things on the internet, and continue to do so, a blunt tool like that isn't going to work. I do think that when you look at the GAFA companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, you've got to think they are capable of addressing this. I mean, their economic power is the same as the GDP of France, right? It's £1.6 trillion. That they generate each year. By the way, France has a population of, I think, 67 million, something like that, and the number of employees of the GAFA companies is about the same as Leicester. So you would expect, with that extraordinary resource at their hands, they should be able to do something about it. I think the question, as I've reflected, I think, in my talk, is whether they're going to do anything about it, and in the end, whether the level of public concern is such that actually there's going to have to be a massive overcorrection from them. Because in this country, you've now got a situation where two-thirds of the public believe that we need much tougher regulation for social media companies, because they are worried about encountering fake news online. They're worried that they believe that these organisations haven't done enough to line up against some of the challenges around fake news, around extremist content, around bullying online, and so on and so forth. I mean, the fact of the matter is these companies are run by brilliant people in many respects, you know, incredibly smart people, very innovative people, who want to do and are motivated by, I think, really good values. And so, you know, doing social good. I mean, if you think about the case for YouTube, it's about actually democratizing content. So actually, there is a lot of good in these companies. It's just how they, I think, line up against the public concerns, that, and whether they'll do it within the time frame that policymakers want them to do it. Now, on fake news itself, my word, it is incredibly difficult when you look at what's happening in places in Macedonia that are literally pumping out this stuff. I mean, there has to be an answer around trying to disincentivize fake news, the creation of fake news around commercial motives. So if Google has started to do this. So if you can make it not financially attractive to create this content, I think that would go some way at least to kind of reducing the volume. Because, you know, I remember reading an interview last year with the guy who wrote that absolutely ridiculous fake news story about Hillary Clinton and the pizza restaurant, if you read that, right? This guy was making, at the time, tens of thousands of dollars of advertising revenue each day with that story. I mean, it was driving amazing commercial outcomes for him. So I think if you can somehow attack that, you go some way to solving, I would say.
Hi there, my name is Jean Miguel. I am a comparative politics student. You were mentioning earlier that the media needs to be more accountable and to show that they are public good, if you want. How can the media do so while also bearing in mind the financial challenges they face, particularly when the clickbait model is so profitable? So how do you balance those two things?
I mean, the really interesting phenomenon that we have seen over the last 2 years is essentially the undermining of the conventional wisdom that you can't make money out of news anymore. That actually the cost of producing news is so prohibitively high that you can't generate sufficient revenues to offset the decline in traditional advertising revenue. And, you know, many newspapers, as you will know, have treated that problem by stripping out newsrooms, by making massive cuts to journalist numbers, to what, you know, the so-called backbench, so the sub-editors and editors, and instead seeking to boost revenues through things like, you know, selling cruises and, you know, flogging wine and the like. And look, for some newspapers that has helped. But I think what we've seen in America with the New York Times and the Post is actually you can, a competitive advantage, you can drive a competitive advantage through actually maintaining and indeed increasing investment in your newsroom and in journalism, but then being much smarter about how you segment your audience. So if you look at what the New York Times is doing at the moment, they are thinking, do you know what? People have a certain number of kind of passion interests, if you like. It might be travel. It might be food. It might be crosswords. We should package up high-quality professional content that is then targeted at those individual audiences and drive additional revenue to existing revenue through those passion interests. So, for example, I don't have the figures to hand, but the story around paid subscriptions to solely the New York Times crossword has been an amazing story for them. So they've monetized one part of the book, the crossword. And so they're thinking in an incredibly sophisticated way about doing that. Now, is that true over here? Not yet, right? You look at, you look at big, mainstream news titles, newspapers I'm thinking of course here, like The Times and The Telegraph and The Guardian and so on. And there hasn't yet been that segmentation strategy happen. There are attempts at it and you start to see it a little bit, but it hasn't happened yet. So I think you can do it. It just requires a different model. But the answer is not to it sounds obvious, doesn't it? The answer is not to de-invest in the newsroom.
Yeah, in the middle. So, well, okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Just got, my name is Rosha, just from the public, and used to study here. I would just find it interesting, do you think this is linked to the economic performance as well? Because in the past 6-7 years, we have seen the global economy is in a downturn, and this year, finally, we see a recovery. Do you think it's a linkage between the trust and economic growth? Or maybe not directly, but maybe from inequality we have seen?
Yeah. It's a brilliant question, and what you ask actually allows me to talk about another deviation that we've seen this year, which is actually the uncoupling of trust from the economy. So if you look at America, we have seen a decline in trust in government, the likes of which we haven't seen in 18 years of studying trust. It's now at very low levels, off the top of my head, around low 30s, something like that. Significant double-digit declines in trust in government. At the same time that the economy is performing, until a couple of days ago, mind you, the stock market was doing tremendously well. Forgive the use of the Donald Trump's favourite word. Employment, we pretty much had full employment in America. So the economic indicators were really good. I mean, the truth is, I think what we've seen is that you can have really strong economic performance, but people will say, well, that's your GDP, that's not my GDP. The experience I have is stagnant wage inflation, massive disruption to my life through technology, massive disruption to the industries that I'm in. If you think about the number of people in America who are in the trucking industry, it's many, many millions of people. And the disruption that they're going to face, I think, will absolutely kind of reinforce and cement the kind of decline in trust, institutional trust, that we've seen in our data this year. Now, that's not true right across the board. You see very, very low institutional levels of trust in industrialized countries, in Europe and in America. But then if you go to countries like China, you go to the UAE, you go to Singapore, the picture is very, very different. But I think it's a very long-winded way of saying, actually, I think you're seeing a decoupling of trust and economic performance.
At the back, the last row there.
Thanks. My name is Mark, and I work in the ad tech industry. So I just wanted to go back to your point about the raison d'etre of these upstart publishers that create fake news stories that very quickly get virality, and the fact that it's not always around shaping opinion and serving particular agendas, but in many cases it's purely to drive profit through, in our industry, what we call buying traffic on arbitrage. Yeah. So with that in mind, should we also, in addition to trying to hold social media channels or platforms accountable, shift our focus to advertising regulators like the IAB and perhaps ask them to hold advertising vendors a little bit more accountable, or at least be place more scrutiny on them when it comes to vetting these upstart publishers? Because in many cases, when they start up, they're starting from zero and then buying traffic from day dot. Mm-hmm. So they don't really have any organic traffic to start with. So perhaps I think there's definitely something that can be done there to say, well, clearly you're not a legitimate business, and clearly you are here just to buy traffic on arbitrage.
I mean, I think it is an excellent point. And I think there's the IAB a meeting in Miami next week. And I think this whole topic will be part of the agenda, and there'll be a number of people speaking to your precise point. Because you are right, the vast majority of fake news is motivated by commercial aims. And therefore the advertising industry itself has a role to play. And I think it speaks to a broader point as well, which is, I think we need to be very careful that we don't demonize tech and we don't demonize social media, because actually, you know, we're not going to see people coming off these platforms. The vast majority of people still see value in social media as ways of connecting with friends and family, of sharing their lives and getting information. So, you know, these are organizations that are not going away, but they should be held to a higher standard, and they should be leading sort of the industry and leading the debate, perhaps in a way maybe they've been reluctant to in the past. But trying to build a broader consensus around this and addressing, you know, other stakeholders like advertisers and bringing them to the table to try and figure out what can be done about it, I think is an absolutely brilliant idea.
Yeah, the woman there behind the...
Hi, Ellie Dobner from HP. I was actually wondering if you think that identifying fake news should be part of the education for Gen Y and Gen X. Should that be something that young people and millennials now should learn to identify, as your figures show that it's actually quite a high percentage that people can't tell the difference?
Yeah.
What do you think?
So, look, 100% agree. I mean, I think media literacy, which is the point you speak to, is one of the, you know, critical faculties that I think we should arm all of our children. I mean, my son is 5.5, and I would hope that through his education he would learn to know the difference between that Guardian story that we saw earlier and the real thing. Not least, I hope he would realise that that's a terrible headline, apart from anything. But you're absolutely right that we should be investing in this. Now, there are examples of where this is happening. So James Harding at the BBC announced just before Christmas a programme to try and drive better education around fake news, so the BBC are doing it. I think this is something the government should look at in terms of the national curriculum. And I suspect, and I could be, you know, I'm not an education expert. Somebody will probably tell me afterwards they are already looking at it. If they are, they should talk about it a little bit more. But giving people the confidence and the mental faculties to be able to differentiate between the kind of Macedonian story and the objective truth, alongside a number of other measures we can take, I think is right. And your point is, I think, important, because what you're saying is there's not a single answer to this, right? There's a range of policy prescriptions that I think are going to address this, and I think media literacy is one of them.
Hi, Jack Watling, a journalist. I was wondering whether you could comment on the fact that we've seen a response to fake news. You've said commercially driven, but a lot of it is also government driven. In contrast to Macedonia, you had the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. RT in France has been restricted. In the US, I think it's been forced to declare itself as a foreign agency. Is there a risk that you end up having essentially Russian information and British information and American information rather than true and false, and you lose that dichotomy as the distinguishing component? And could you kind of comment on the fragmentation of audience that we've observed as well? You might have a lot of people engaging with the media, but are they engaging with the same media, and can they engage with the same media?
So, I mean, two very good questions. So I'll just give you a little anecdote, actually, on RT. So last year I did a bunch of focus groups outside London, and one of the areas I was talking to people about was media consumption. And what I found was, as you went further out from London, trust in the BBC
declined, and indeed trust in traditional media also declined. And I encountered one individual who said, look, I don't watch the BBC anymore because I don't trust it. It's biased. The reason I said earlier, right, is biased reporting. It's too liberal. But instead, I watch a really rather brilliant news channel called RT. And it really does give me a much clearer sense of what's going on in the world. The way that they communicate, the way they tell stories. Unlike the BBC, which is clearly a biased organisation. My husband watches it as well, she said. And I said, do you know what RT stands for? Out of interest. And she said, no, absolutely no idea. No idea. So statecraft, through the use of state channels, I think is a potentially, well, certainly in the case of RT, is an extremely pernicious phenomenon. And for me, the answer is not about prescription, about making these, banning these, prescribing these TV channels. Because I'm not up for banning things, right? I don't think you should, I'm up for educating people. I mean, first thing I would say is, you know, you should know that RT is Russia Today, right? That might give you a clue as to whether you think it's a credible and trustworthy news source or not. So I don't think you should ban at all. Because I think, where does that end and who makes the judgment? Instead, I think the answer is we need to invest in public media itself, in public service broadcasting. And this is a phenomenon that I haven't talked about tonight, but you look around the world and you see public service broadcasting under attack, right? Everywhere from Australia to Italy to small countries like Iceland, where public media, not state media, but publicly owned media, is being eroded and stymied and very cleverly positioned to remain in a box. So in Iceland, for example, the enemies of public service broadcasting, I gather, have said, look, you keep broadcasting on TV, but you can't do digital. Just stick to TV, don't do digital, right? That is a slow death, as we know, right? It's not, you know, it's not presented as a slow death, but the consequence is a slow death. Public broadcasting in America is a diminishing pie, right? So for me, the answer is don't ban these channels, but instead let's actually figure out how do we invest in public media where we can. And I think it is a worrying trend to see the attacks that the BBC has encountered over the last few years at the hands of this government. That is not in the public interest, I would say. Now, in terms of fragmentation, I mentioned earlier this phenomenon of sort of news skimming. I mean, and this is the great paradox, right? Or irony of the internet, that on the one hand you're suddenly faced with this extraordinary multiplicity and plurality of sources, but actually what you're seeing behaviourally is that people are not reading anything in any detail at all anymore, and they're skimming from title to title to title. So you're not getting any depth of understanding or depth of knowledge anymore. I wish I had the answer to what you do about that. I really don't know. Other than trying to, you know, doubling down on creating really high quality content that people want to consume in detail. I also think if you look at, I mentioned him before, but if you look at what James Harding is planning to do with his new media business, it's about how, you know, he will look at how you can deliver really thoughtful and smart and deep journalistic content in a new way that doesn't involve, doesn't involve very, very long form articles, although they still have their place. I remember a very, very, very funny story about the commissioning of the first piece of really brilliant multimedia content from the New York Times. It was called Snowfall, and if you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing. It's basically the story of this terrible tragedy where a bunch of what they would call backcountry skiers, i.e. off-piste skiers, died in a terrible avalanche. And it was a beautiful multimedia experience with video, with long-form text and the rest. And the writer took the original piece to the New York Times editor and laid it out, and it was 15,000 words. Huge piece of journalism. And she read the piece and said, I don't think it's long enough. I want to commission another 4,000 words. and so that, you know, there's a place for pieces of journalism like that. And I know, Jack, I know some of the long form pieces that you have done, which it really is worth spending the time reading them. But it's about how you create the right mix. So that actually if people are going to skim, they're skimming high quality material, not low quality junk.
The woman at the back row.
Hi, my name's Sophie, a member of the public. Just to follow on from your Russia Today piece, I thought you'd find it quite interesting. I do have a question. The Wetherspoons have recently just contracted out their TVs, and Russia Today have just bought the entire contract so that Wetherspoons will be continually showing Russia Today on all their programme, which brings me to my second question. We're seeing that state actors are often effectively weaponizing fake news, especially in conflicts around the world. Mm-hmm. If such a scenario is to happen, what do you think the government's response and private industry's response should be if effectively they are under attack from it? How should they kind of respond to that kind of things?
So certainly in this country, I know the government think a lot about this. And there are various arms of government that are trying to figure out how do you respond to that kind of information attack, if you like. There is part of the British Army, I think it's called Brigade 77, I think. Am I right, Jack? Right, Brigade, there we go. I've got my fact checker, thankfully. Brigade 77, this is a group of both private sector, through the kind of the reserve program, plus full-time members of the British Army are trying to figure out how do we, in that scenario, how do we counter propaganda? How do we repel it? The really challenging thing, though, when you think about it, is if you think about what happened in the US presidential election, right? When you've got a public that already have a particular point of view about an individual, say Hillary Clinton, and they are then served denigrating and fake stories about that individual, it is extremely difficult to disrupt that point of view, right? It is really, really hard. And so the truth is we're going to have to get much smarter and much more sophisticated in how we think about this problem, because, you know, the opponents of objective truth are, you know, they don't have the same kind of ethical scruples and, moral compass that we have. I mean, it is also worth saying, in terms of Russia's intervention in the US election, I'm yet to be convinced that it was a kind of mastermind plot from the top. Actually, you think about Russia, and Russia is essentially a dysfunctional company run by a sort of dysfunctional chief executive, and I suspect, I don't know, I mean, we'll see in the various investigations that are taking place, I suspect that there was a sort of degree of freelancing on this basis rather than a really concerted effort to undermine American democracy. But who knows, I could be completely wrong on that. Nevertheless, the outcome was the outcome. Was it good for Russia? Probably not, actually. Did it damage the standing of Russia in the world and Russia's relationships around the rest of the world? Almost certainly, yes. But your question is a good one, and it's one that I think government should be worrying away at.
Okay, the woman there with the glasses.
Thank you. My name is Julia. I'm a postgraduate student here. I was wondering about, because you've been mostly talking about the media and journalists in general, even though we were talking about the fragmentation, and referring to your third point, journalists must fight to be heard. How do you think journalists who produce actually high-quality content should encounter their colleagues, or colleagues, so to say, who call themselves journalists, who deliberately produce not very well-researched content, low-quality journalism, and how should journalists, like, within the media profession, kind of defend their own profession, the ones who subscribe to values of truth and yeah, good quality journalism? How should they face this debate within the profession?
So, look, I mean, a few remarks on this point. I mean, the first thing I would say is that in the end, this is about, you know, battle over quality, right? And if you are, you know, if you're on the right side of that debate, and you are creating and producing the high quality journalism, journalism that holds power to account, journalism that enlightens, journalism that reveals truth, I think the organisations that you work for need to do probably a better job of promoting, if that's the right word, and marketing and distributing that content, I would say. But in the end, you know, I don't think we're ever going to see a world in which kind of junk news, junk reporting is kind of, that doesn't exist. I mean, it's a bit like thinking we should all eat kind of healthy meals all the time and not go to McDonald's. There's always going to be junk news that people like. And also, I think we have to be not too kind of puritanical about this and not too sniffy. You know, there will be, I'm sure, people here in this room who would say, I'd never look at the Mail online because that's junk news. Well, to a lot of people who read it, it isn't junk news. That actually there's political reporting, there's some business stories, there's some international stories. I mean, you might not like the way they produce the journalism. You might not like the format that it takes. You certainly might not like the fact that it sits so close to kind of a stream of showbiz stories, driven by imagery more so than less. But I think there's a place for a lot of journalism. It doesn't have to be all kind of high-minded exclusives by the FT or, you know, Atlantic or The Economist or whatever. But where there are journalists producing really, really high-quality content, I think news media need to get behind that and promote it and get it out there in a way that they haven't done up to this point, I would say. But I'm afraid there's always going to be bad journalism. There's nothing we can do about that.
One last question.
Hello, my name is Ritika. I am a journalism student from India. You raised the point that social media is actually ruining our lives and everything, but don't you believe it is removing the gap between the common people and the journalists and authorities, that we get a space to talk about our problems and discuss it with the people directly? Also, about the fake news thing, I think there are various authentic websites, not websites, on social media pages and channels who have, they have authentic journalists in them, and they have started with the thing called crowdsourcing, yeah, where they take up stories from common people and check the facts, and then they put it online to make it public. So don't you think that would actually bring down the communication gap and at the same time would improve the, remove fake news as well? What do you think about that?
So this is a really good sort of last question. About, I'm feeling old now. About 15 years ago, my colleague at Reuters, Tom Gloser, wrote a piece for the FT called the Two-Way Pipe of Media. And it was about how media is changing from the one-way distribution of information to two-way, right? And specifically about personalization of media, about citizen journalism and so on and so forth. And actually, there is, of course, a really important role and that we can't, you know, for this type of content, and that we've got to be very careful that we don't lose. This is why the fear of blunt regulation is such that actually really important contributions like that somehow are kind of, you know, are discarded. And it is important. I mean, I'll give you an example. So back in, I think, around 2005, 2006, Reuters was covering the Israel-Lebanon war. And a stringer published a photograph of an Israeli jet dropping ordnance on the Lebanon. And it was a pretty dramatic photograph. And it would still be, you know, on the public record today if it wasn't for an individual, I think in America or Canada or somewhere like that, who looked at the photograph and realized that the photograph had actually been doctored, that missiles had been kind of photoshopped in. And it was a terrible scandal and a crisis for Reuters, you know, one of the most trustworthy news brands in the world. And that wouldn't have happened if the internet hadn't existed and that individual hadn't have taken the time to study the photograph and realize what had gone on. You know, fake news then, fake news now. So I think, you know, citizen journalism and the importance of social media as a communication channel to engage for politicians and for media companies and for individual citizens is really important. This is my point, the point I made earlier. We mustn't demonize tech and social media, but we've got to recognize that there are some really serious public concerns. And the thing to do is to address those public concerns, so all of the good that has come from tech and social media and the like over the last decade or so remains. And, you know, my final point is around kind of, don't write off traditional media, and I hope you go away thinking that tonight. I mean, I made the comment earlier about the FT and the President's Club being a great kind of investigative piece. And, you know, however much we might, in this room, might not necessarily like it, but actually you look at somebody like Donald Trump, and he's a master of traditional media as much as he is a master of social media. I was saying earlier when we talked before we kicked off here, you know, one of the, you know, I strongly believe the reason that Donald Trump was so successful in his election campaign was he's already introduced himself to the American public through traditional media, through television. He'd had 20 years on network television, on The Apprentice, with audiences of 24, 25 million. Imagine that in living rooms, 20 years on that channel. He'd introduced himself, and the power of TV was such that he was a known entity and he was a public figure by the time he announced. And not only that, you would say, you know, when it comes to newspapers, his campaign must have been an absolute disaster because they excoriated him. He only got, I think, kind of one or two media endorsements from a newspaper. But of course, if you're going to cast yourself as an anti-establishment character, as a anti-politics character, it's a brilliant media strategy. Upset the traditional media and let them attack you, and then you're able to differentiate yourself. So he used traditional media incredibly effectively, as effectively as he uses social media to communicate directly. So that really is my sort of final point. Don't rule out traditional media. I think it's still an incredibly important medium and will continue to be. And let's see this time next year whether the trust that we've seen in traditional media, that 13-point jump in this country, whether that is sustainable, whether that jump in trust in journalists is sustainable. I do, as I say, as a former journalist, I do hope so.
I think this is a very good note to close this event. I just want to thank Ed again for such an interesting presentation, and thank you for such good questions. Thank you.
Brilliant questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.